Welcome to Crosstalks, Conversations that Drive Innovation. In this podcast, we featured well-known payments expert Hugo Cuevas Moore. This series is based on his 2023 book, Sending Money, Forex, Remittances, Migration, and the FinTech Revolution. Crosstalks is published by Crosstech, a conference and consultancy service company based in Miami, Florida. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I want to continue to tell the story of how financial inclusion came to be with the sending and paying of remittances when EFTs were introduced and faxes became the dominant technology. In the summer of 2018, I went to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, which is close to the Google headquarters that I was visiting. And I realized that it was the first museum where I was older than everything that was on display. I could remember the punch cards, the first servers, my old Mac, hardware and software, and everything we worked with to build the money transfer industry. There are many anecdotes from the early days on how technology evolution impacted the operation in both sides of a corridor, and in our case, in our central office in Cali and our branches. We had a whole battery of faxes, the incoming ones on one side, where we had 15, 20, and the outgoing ones on the other side. All the companies that worked with these machines remember the common problems, the paper jams, the constant resending, the paper running out, until they started coming with memory chips that store the information, the ink or ribbon running out. Countless issues that we had to deal with. Every technology leap draws its complaints, since you soon forget how everything was before. The sending of digital file was not an option, and printing, faxing, and retyping was the process to follow. Floppy disks were first sent using messengers in motorbikes or taxis from one place to the other to avoid retyping and the associated mistakes. A means of helping the communication between sender and recipient led to creating a message field with each money transfer that was sent. It provided the sender a way to send a message along with the transaction information. It is debatable who came with this idea first, but it very soon spread to all money transfer operators, because they understood the importance of giving the sender this option to provide a message with that payment order. We printed the message on the receipt given to the beneficiary when they signed the remittance receipt. We didn't anticipate clients would ask the cashier to read it for them. And this happened because the person could not read or because they wanted to hear the words, which made the message more real and personal. His messages ranged from simple, profound declarations of love. I love you very much, Mami Linda. Please be gentle with Marielita. Don't lose your patience with her. To very practical instructions like, you know, from this $120, take $40 for you, $25 for Juan to pay for college, and the rest for fixing the roof. For Mother's Day, Christmas, every payment had a message attached to it. In an interview for the book, Rob Ayers, called the father of MoneyGram, remembered how in Paris on a Christmas day with his friend and colleague Alfredo O'Hagan, they filled all the message fields that were empty with the Christmas cheer. They wanted all the money transfers to carry the season's love and affection. The industry had a very tough time convincing banks to accept deposits of funds into bank accounts. Titan provided the service of bank deposits by sending messengers with cash to deposit them in the intended accounts. But when the number of deposits grew, many banks complained that our messengers were taking too much time from their tellers and even restricted the hours or the number of daily deposits we could make. But partnerships with banks were impossible back then, and, you know, they still are in a way. But in the 80s and 90s, very few clients had bank accounts, so it was not that big of an issue. It is also important to understand that international communications were deficient and they were expensive in the 1980s. Technological advances in communication from 1990 to 2000 changed the industry and also the contact between migrant families. In the sending countries, money transfer agencies installed calling booths, locutorios, as they were first called in Spain, where migrants could call their relatives cheaper and talk longer. Computers appeared alongside these cabin booths so migrants could send the first emails and learn how to use the internet. Agents gave call minutes as a reward to senders who used them to inform the beneficiary that they were sending money and, in some cases, give the pickup code when required. Agents' offices filled with telephone booths became the norm, and the public crowded in to talk to their loved ones, especially at the end of the day or at night. Several U.S. and European neighborhoods persecuted the locutorios for being the centers for migrant gatherings that disturbed the locals. Remittance companies, agents, and branches were constantly challenged by the ignorance of the local community and the police, who were called to disperse these dangerous crowds. Now, migration officials and police would also raid these locales to keep them in check or pick up illegals. The calling card replaced the booth. The calling card was a piece of plastic containing a service access codes that users could dial from any telephone. Offers of cheaper minutes were constantly changing. The success of calling cards and later on the way for senders to buy minutes for cell phones, to top up phones, as it is called, so their families could call them, made communication companies very interested in serving migrants. The profits these communication companies were making serving migrants were the reason for their subsequent entry into providing remittance services. Communications made the sender and recipient closer. Voice over IP, WhatsApp, and Facebook Messenger appeared, and thus the message field with the money transfer became obsolete. Understanding the customer, the one we had in front of us, expecting payment, was our primary job. In the beginning, we did not understand the importance of understanding the sender. But as we developed the service, as we opened our own offices in sending markets, and learned more about the migration phenomenon, we realized that there were many complex situations we had to solve concerning mostly the occupations of the senders. Here are three examples that I think are worthwhile mentioning. The first one is the particular case of migrants working on merchant cargo and container ships, deep sea fishing vessels, and cruise ships on the open sea who spend months on board, totally unreachable back then. When they landed at a port along the way, they will then send money home using an agent was stationed near the docks. Due to the nature of this remittance and the impossibility of asking for corrections in case the transfer had mistakes, as it could take months to get any information, made these orders a high priority. So exceptions had to be made, especially regarding names or making an extra effort to locate the beneficiary when the phone numbers were invalid or inaccurate. Most of these sailors on international routes are migrants, as most of the ships they embark on are transnational. Now, close to 50% of the world's shipping fleet is transnational and do not abide by any laws of any country. Ships have hierarchical structure depending on the sailor's education, nationality, and role. Officers are normally from developed countries. Then there is a mixed layer of employees depending on the type of ship, and down in the engines, Indonesians, Filipinos, or crew members from other Asian or African countries. Maria Borovnik from Massey University in New Zealand wrote this, which I will read to you. Though they cannot be described as migrants, and quite often cannot establish a kin-based community while living on board ships, they still remain strongly connected with their families at home by regular communication with them and by sending remittances. Now, whether they are considered migrants or not, they all send remittances to their families because they have a home or family they visit and care for somewhere in the world, a home that gives meaning to their job, to their lives. The Philippines takes good care of these foreign workers, overseas foreign workers, or OFW, as they are called. In 2019, a total of more than 500,000 seamen were counted, sending more than $6.5 billion, 22% of the total remittances coming into the Philippines. Some companies train seamen in developing countries to become workers on the thousands of ships that travel the world's oceans. In Kiribati, a republic in Oceania, of 33 islands, a school prepares sailors for Japanese tuna fishing boats. They became world news when, due to COVID, 600 of them were left scattered around the world without a living and unable to return home. Some took almost 2 years to be rescued by NGOs, the United Nations, and in some cases, their own country's government. Nowadays, specialized cross-techs are developing digital solutions for these seafarers to handle their remittances from wherever they are, even aboard the ships, as well as payment applications for the companies recruiting and providing payments for them or to them. Workers in mining, oil, or construction camps, where thousands of migrants work, living in isolated structures far from urban and social environments, present a similar case. They also send money home. Construction projects in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar are examples of these occupations. And migrant rights, international labor management, remittances, cross-border payments have all been in the news as these countries get more attention from the media and human rights NGOs. So we had to be very careful with those remittances. And as I said, make exceptions when we felt that it was missing information, but there was no way we could get that information in due time. Migrants in prison who send money or needed to receive money also deserve special treatment. In some countries, such as the U.S., prisoners can work for meager wages and in very difficult situations, but still they manage to generate some savings. Some of them, incarcerated migrants, needed to send money to their loved ones, and we needed to provide a way to achieve this. This service to migrants in U.S. prisons was developed jointly with Rapido Giros in Miami in 1992, when we opened the office there. Rapid Envios continued the service after Rapido Giros was closed in 1994. This was the procedure. The inmate will call the office collect, and an attendant will write down the information and give the caller instructions on how to proceed for the money to arrive to us. The inmates had to request the prison clerk for a federal government-issued check, called a treasury check, in the company's name and had it sent officially to our office in Miami. Once the check arrived, which could take weeks, it was deposited, and following the inmate's instructions, the transfer was then sent to the family. We designed a form mailed to them, enclosing also the receipt, so they could fill it with the information of a subsequent transfer request, which they could send by mail or at least gave them the information what to provide on a phone call if they would call. Little by little, they learned to call only that the form was on its way and they had petitioned the check. Now, due to the frequent change of prison of foreign conscripts, the inmate number that came on the treasury check was very important because this was a way to confirm via phone consultation and later on the internet where the conscript was being held. It was a very intense manual labor process performed at no extra charge. But the gratitude of the senders was so great that the satisfaction of providing this service was unparalleled. Moreover, it was spontaneously promoted by word of mouth and from prison to prison, inmate to inmate. In 15 years of providing this service, more than 4,000 individuals were served, mainly from Colombia, Nicaragua, and Mexico. The remittances were usually small sums, and occasionally, when they had served their sentences and when they were being deported, a larger check would arrive, which could be $1,000 or $2,000 at the most. We were the only way for them to receive the check and have the money sent home. They did not want to risk taking cash in that long journey and long deportation processes. And upon arrival, they will write grateful letters, including photos of their reunited families. We tried in many instances to reach out to the Federal Bureau of Prisons or its state counterparts to expand the service to other prisons and to improve the process to make it faster and more efficient. But our efforts failed, as the subject was unimportant to the Bureau, and basically nobody cared. Besides, officials had difficulty understanding what we were doing. Some of the prisons prohibited inmates from using our services without any explanations. In 2022, in the U.S., there were over 2 million prisoners in its jails, the largest number in the world, both in number and per capita. About 42,000 U.S. inmates are foreigners, or just below 2%. 13,000 are Mexicans, around 1,500 are Colombians, as 1,400 Dominican. With the opening of our offices in Panama and Costa Rica, we had to address another social group that needed special care. And understanding their occupation and how to handle these remittances became also very important. Under Titan's guidance, Raul Martinez established a remittance business in Panama around 1990 without being aware of the type of clients he would serve initially. His wife worked at the Colombian consulate in Panama and had first-hand knowledge of the increasing number of Colombians that were entering the country back then. The remittance operation began in their apartment. When he was open for business, he discovered that most customers were Colombian women working in the Canal Zone and Panama City in entertainment venues. Sending money frequently made them less vulnerable to police raids and robberies by customers or thieves. Thus, every 2 to 3 days, they would visit the apartment to send their remittances to their families in Colombia. As a result of receiving these colorful women in his apartment and serving them continuously throughout the day, Raul gained a very bad reputation among other tenants in his apartment building. So soon, he had to find an office space to provide the service, and thus Universal de Giros in Panama was born. When NTOs in Spain and Switzerland began to come into terms with this particular customer base, the human perspective gave way to compliance considerations that became difficult to manage. Marcela Gonzalez, Titan executive who worked in RIA many years and now in Intermex, in one of her trips visiting correspondents in Europe, she witnessed the problem. I will read an excerpt of her interview. An issue that had a great impact on me happened in Switzerland, visiting a correspondent we had begun to work with. I realized that several clients were Colombian, professional women who had decided to work in sexual services there, which puzzled me. I decided to speak to them. One showed me the crinkled photos of her family that she pulled from her purse. I am sending this money to my daughter so my mother can celebrate her quinceañera. Marcela could relate to the sadness and nostalgia expressed by this young mother, the distant daughter, and the hard work these women had to bring joy to their relatives at the expense of their well-being. When compliance demanded that we requested to ask clients to identify the source of funds, a word that we did not know came up, alterne. We learned that alterne was a word used in Spain and that the Real Academia Dictionary defines as serving customers in party clubs. One day, a distressed mother at a cashier window of one of our offices in Colombia, while she was receiving a remittance payment, made a comment that a man in the waiting room was the one who had tricked her daughter into taking her to work abroad. The cashier had seen the man before. As she related to the branch manager this situation, and just digging a little bit deeper, the story took on a very sad and dramatic overtone, in addition to the criminal and laundering components that were revealed to us. We noticed that some of these remittance senders, these women abroad, were simultaneously sending money to a family member and another person, usually a man whose last name did not appear to be related. Besides, we discovered that these men were receiving remittances from different women, and mostly from Europe. So by analyzing the names of these suspicious beneficiaries, we were able to identify patterns that helped us block individuals in our system and inform correspondents who in turn could put these people in a no-send list. We were confronting something called Trata de Blancas, which translates to white slave trade. The term is seldom used anymore. The term human trafficking, which involves all types of individuals and crimes, is used nowadays. The traffic of people for sexual exploitation used remittances to move payments from the trafficked persons to the traffickers at the origin, and we had to do something about it. On a trip to Spain, I understood the issue much better by talking to a consular official who told me about Fundación Esperanza in Bogotá. This Fundación, this NGO, was helping at the time extradited and abused Colombian women and held international agreements with other similar organizations in several countries working on the sexual slavery traffic. They helped us in our desire to minimize our risk of becoming enablers of human trafficking without constraining the payment of remittances to the family members of these women working abroad. I must remark that the detection of remittances involved with human trafficking is very difficult. And this is not an excuse for financial institutions to do their best to stop this and help authorities do that. For us, it was frustrating to see that once these individuals, pimps, traffickers, exploiters, were blocked in our system, they stopped claiming the remittances at our cash registers, but instead received them outside our offices, waiting to be handed out by a relative who had just claimed a money transfer. Together with Fundación Esperanza, we found ways to alert authorities who were working on this front. For the first time in history, we managed to develop a common strategy with other remittance payment companies. And in the year 2000, we all participated in the dismantling of our network in the so-called Operación Gaviota, which after 120 raids, resulting in the arrest of more than 20 people and the dismantling of a gang operating in several cities with connections in 7 countries. The case of human trafficking and smuggling by coyotes on the U.S. southern border and the networks that help Chinese migrants enter the U.S. is a widely discussed topic among compliance officers of cross-border payment companies. How to help authorities detect those activities and how much authorities place the blame on payment companies for failing to do enough is an issue that industry will debate for many years to come. In 2018, Western Union paid a $60 million fine for the actions of 3 agents in New York related to human trafficking from China. The last example I want to discuss is remittance customers in transit. When we began sending remittances from Colombia to Central American countries, many transactions showed us the migrants' path to enter the U.S. For instance, the family would first send money to a beneficiary in Panama. Then we will see that the family send money to the same beneficiary now in Costa Rica, then Guatemala, and further on to Mexico. After a few months, we will see the beneficiary becoming a sender and the family the receiver of the remittances. In the next episode, episode 13, I will discuss compliance as part of the financial inclusion of remittance senders and beneficiaries, and how this part of the money transfer process began and consolidated. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crosstalks, Conversations That Drive Innovation. The book, Sending Money, is available on Amazon. For comments, questions, and feedback, use our social media channels, LinkedIn, Facebook, and YouTube. See you soon.